Hello everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Hendrik Meyer about his biography of the 20th century American politician and statesman Arthur Vandenberg, entitled Arthur Vandenberg, The Man in the Middle of the American Century. Hank, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's good to be with you.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
I am currently involved in our family retail business based in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and we have retail stores, I guess we call them super centers, akin to the Walmart variety, although we like to think that ours have a distinctively higher standard. But I'm executive chairman of this family business, but in my earlier life, I was a reporter and editor in the newspaper business, and went to the University of Michigan, where I was an English major, and then did graduate work in history at Western Michigan University, and had written a biography of my grandfather, who was a sort of a radical political immigrant turned barber turned entrepreneur who opened a grocery store in the Great Depression. And after that, really fell in love with the biography form and wanted to tackle another subject, and one that was that I had always been curious about as a student of history and an observer of international relations, was the story of a senator from Michigan, from my hometown of Grand Rapids, named Arthur Vandenberg.
What was it about Vandenberg in particular that drew your attention?
My elevator speech would be that he's the most important politician or public figure of the 20th century in the United States for whom there was no biography. And I realize that could be an ambitious statement, but Arthur Vandenberg, who began his life also in the newspaper business as a reporter and then editor in Grand Rapids, became a United States Senator in 1928, when, as on the advent of Herbert Hoover's election as president, and built his early career in the Senate, among other things, as an outspoken isolationist, as an opponent of American intervention before World War II, and then after the war, found himself as perhaps the most influential American delegate at the creation of the United Nations in San Francisco in 1945, instrumental in writing the UN Charter, and then engineered the passage of the Marshall Plan, which General Marshall always said could have been called the Vandenberg Plan, through Congress in 1948, and then wrote the Vandenberg Resolution, which enabled United States participation in the creation of NATO. And so he moved from being an isolationist who felt very strongly and really took as his mantra Hamilton's words in Washington's farewell address about avoiding entangling alliances, went from there to being an advocate for America's role as a global leader and its responsibility to be engaged in the world, to of necessity become involved in entangling alliances. And that transformation, I think, mirrored a recognition more broadly among the American people that our place in the world had changed and our responsibilities had changed.
In that respect, it seems that it might be more accurate to say that to have as a subtitle, The Man Who Personifies the American Evolution, in that how he seems to undergo it within himself the shift that the United States takes over the course of the first half of the 20th century from this position of, you know, detachment from global affairs to this position of being at the center of it.
I think that's absolutely true. And he was of that generation coming out of World War I, when he, like so many others, had been inspired in part, even though he was a lifelong Republican, by Woodrow Wilson's notion of a crusade to make the world safe for democracy, to justify and motivate American involvement in World War I. And when that crusade ended in the bitter fruits of Versailles and the seeds of future conflict, future war. He was one of those people who took that to heart and said, we've learned a lesson here. We're not going to get burned again. And that's how so many Americans, not only those coming back from the war, but so many others felt at that time. And you're right. I think he's a reflection. In fact, one of his Senate colleagues in the later 1940s had a quote that I always loved. He said, Van changes his mind about as often as the average American, but slightly earlier. In other words, like you said, he reflected and mirrored those changes, but because he was coming to that awakening a little sooner than the electorate, he wasn't way out in front with no followers, and I wouldn't claim that he was a visionary, but his thoughts were evolving just ahead of the broader social changes. And so he was able to both reflect that and bring public opinion along with him, sort of like the converted sinner who becomes a saint because people say, well, if Arthur Vandenberg could make that change, I guess I can too.
I wonder if you could take us back to his early years and explain to our listeners how he, basically how he started out and how he entered the field of public service, of public affairs, and the views that he developed during that period of time.
Sure. He was born in 1884, and his father was a harness maker in Grand Rapids, who had emigrated west, as so many to what I think of as the near frontier, as so many people did in those days in the mid to later 19th century, following the Erie Canal across New York State. His family was from upstate New York, coming to Michigan at the height of the lumber boom, and his father, Aaron Vandenberg's harness making business prospered, but then was nearly wiped out in the biggest economic debacle in America to date at that time, the Panic of 1893. This was during the administration of Grover Cleveland. So the Democrats bore blame in a lot of people's eyes, or Cleveland did, and Vandenberg Sr., as most Northerners of that age, or so many were, was a Republican. And so as a young man, Arthur Vandenberg, when he was 9 years old, he started a little delivery business between a local shoe factory and the railroad station, pulling a handcart, and then finding other boys who could do that too, contributing to the family's income when his father's business was largely ruined. And so he was going to work, and he was imbued with a Republican fervor. His grandfather had been a delegate to the Republican convention that nominated Abraham Lincoln from New York State. And so for him, the celebration of the Grand Army of the Republic with their parades every year in a town like Grand Rapids was a highlight of the year. So he was a politically conscious young man, a hardworking young man. He graduated from the local central high school and got a job in a biscuit factory. And this was in 1900, in the summer of 1900. Well, in September of 1900, the great inspirational leader of that age came through town on a campaign swing. This was Teddy Roosevelt campaigning as a vice presidential candidate with William McKinley. And Arthur Vandenberg was determined to attend the parade for the hero of San Juan Hill when he came to town. And when he got back to the biscuit factory, young Arthur was fired. And so after that, he found a job with the local Republican newspaper, the Grand Rapids Herald, and he had edited his high school paper, so he had already had some exposure to journalism and quickly established himself as the most productive stringer at the newspaper. Spent one In fact, his first byline was on the Electoral College. He claimed that he started reading the Congressional Record when he was 14. We have no evidence of this, but certainly a passion for politics took hold early on. And then spent a year at the University of Michigan, ran out of money, came back, went to work for the Herald again. The Herald was owned by Republican Senator William Alden Smith, whose chief claim to fame was conducting the hearings into the sinking of the Titanic. But Smith had no newspaper background himself. And when his editor died very suddenly, Vandenberg, at the age of 22, as the staff's most productive reporter, was named editor, and then edited that newspaper, later added the title of publisher, for the next 20 years. And what's interesting in that era was how important newspapers were. I mean, obviously, they were the primary sources of information in a community, and most were partisan. And Vandenberg, ambitious to establish himself, as he's writing virtually all the paper's editorials, I think he said he was writing 80% of them, is sending those editorials to Republican leaders around the country. And so when we've gone off to war with World War II, and Wilson comes back from Versailles with the League of Nations Covenant, Vandenberg is actually influencing from his editor's desk in Grand Rapids, Michigan, the debate over the League of Nations. He sends an editorial to Henry Cabot Lodge, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, who is fighting Wilson over the League, approving the League Covenant. And Lodge writes him back and says, I don't know if you were the first to propose reservations, but I think you're on the right track. And in fact, I'm going to use your phrase, unshared idealism is a menace. And so here's Vandenberg influencing, in contact with Henry Cabot Lodge Sr., influencing the debate over the League of Nations, and then being talked about as a potential candidate for public office throughout the 1920s. And then in 1928, with the death of an incumbent Democrat, a fellow named Woodbridge Ferris, the Republican governor who Vandenberg had been instrumental in electing, appoints him to the United States Senate.
One of the advantages of that background, as you illustrate in the book, is that we get to see how he forms his political views and the positions he takes on various issues even before he formally assumes a public office. I was wondering if you could explain a bit his political ideology and how that gives us a bit of insight into the kind of senator that he was. Because it was interesting, as I read the book, I had a certain image in my mind of Vandenberg that comes from the isolationists of the 1930s, the internationalists of the 1940s. And yet you describe a far more complicated character than that simple binary idea of an isolationist who becomes internationalist over the course of his time in the Senate.
I think that's right. He would, of course, deny, well, he acknowledged both those labels at various times, but always with a little hesitation. What he would rather, of course, have said was that he was a nationalist all along. It's just that the role of the nation changed. But he grew up as a hero worshiper, and his hero was Alexander Hamilton. In fact, in the 1920s, he wrote three books tied to Hamilton. And the first one was called The Greatest American. And its pretext was that he wanted to make the argument that Hamilton was the most neglected of the founding fathers and was indeed the greatest American, who had had the greatest impact on the formation of the new republic. And in doing so, he solicits opinions of other leaders around the country and around the world about who they think is the greatest American. And he has Winston Churchill writing in and young Franklin Roosevelt. And the survey is pretty evenly split between Washington and Lincoln as the greatest American. But then, of course, he spends part of the book arguing for Hamilton. But Hamilton was sort of the first were one of the first Republicans in the sense of, at that time, he was building up the economic strength of the country through high tariffs. He was warning against foreign alliances. That was Vandenberg's hero, and in fact, not so much to do with ideology, but also a little bit of insight. Vandenberg's writing this book during the Harding administration, and he talks about, even though he wrote speeches for Warren Harding, wrote Harding's foreign policy address on the League of Nations, in fact, he was also almost overtly acknowledging, I think at one point he talks about an age of second-class men, and therefore he wants to talk about the model of the greatest American. And that colored his thinking all the way through. So even as he may have coined the term normalcy with the return to normalcy slogan of Warren Harding, he told one reporter when he was asked about that, yeah, I think it's something I might have said. He was also tacitly acknowledging that this small-time Ohio publisher really was not what the United States was looking for. But he came out of that strong Republican heritage. In fact, when his father died, he said his deathbed words are said to be, "Son, promise me you'll always be a Republican." And actually, that was also in 1912 when the Bull Moose Party had split apart from the Republicans. And even as Vandenberg worshipped Teddy Roosevelt, he like the institutional stability of the Republican Party and what it stood for, and was a little bit leery of populist appeals.
You mentioned briefly how he became a United States Senator by appointment, but as you explain in the book, it was a little bit more complicated than just that an incumbent senator died and Vandenberg was chosen. I was wondering if you could explain a bit that process of appointment, because it really, I thought, provided a nice window into how politics worked in Michigan at the time.
It really does. It was a rather precious moment. So the governor of Michigan earlier in the 1920s had been a former attorney general named Grossbeck from the Detroit area, and Michigan had traditionally had a rivalry between Detroit and what's called outstate Michigan. And often, in fact, their senators, who until very recently, of course, at that time had been appointed by the legislature, they often struck a balance between those two. Well, Vandenberg didn't like the somewhat more liberal, Detroit-oriented Grossbeck and his machine. And so he was one of the chief advocates for the election of a small town mayor from Western Michigan named Fred Green as governor in the mid-1920s. And Vandenberg had not managed Green's campaign, but he had been one of his most vocal and earliest boosters. And so when the incumbent Democrat dies, Vandenberg had planned this. He died in the spring of 28. Vandenberg, who had been resisting other urges to run for political office, really had always dreamed of the Senate. This guy wanted to go to Washington. He didn't want to start small. And so he had been, and Ferris was an elderly Democrat. He was well respected, but I think he was 76 years old and in frail health before he died. So there was a question of whether he would run for reelection. So Vandenberg is beginning to organize early in 1928 to run for the office that fall when the incumbent suddenly dies. And Vandenberg figures, okay, my guy's in the governor's seat. I'm going to be appointed. Well, that may have happened otherwise, but there were two well-respected former Republican governors who, when it became a matter of, gee, we don't have to run for re-election, for election, we run for office, we can be appointed, threw their hats in the ring too. And so Governor Green was really in a quandary. He had two big party leaders who suddenly wanted that job along with Vandenberg. And while he might have supported Vandenberg in the fall, he thought, you know, I don't want to choose between these guys. And so first he announces that he's going to appoint a retiring congressman just as a placeholder, and then Vandenberg can run in the fall, and therefore Green doesn't have to alienate the former governors. And then and Vandenberg is summoned to Lansing. He thinks to be told that he's going to get the appointment, only to be told that the governor is not in, but his chief of staff or his chief aide informs Vandenberg of this plan to appoint a placeholder so he can run in the fall. And Vandenberg is fuming and feels betrayed, storms out, comes back to Grand Rapids. A day or two later, he gives a speech in another small town, or a scheduled speech, and the local editor there gets a call from one of the Detroit papers that says, you know, we heard that Vandenberg is going to be appointed to the Senate. And Vandenberg said, no, I was told that I wasn't going to. No, we think you are. And at the same time, the Detroit News reporter, and the Detroit News was the dominant Republican newspaper in the state, very influential. The Detroit News reporter observes Vandenberg going into the governor's office for this meeting when he is told he's not going to be appointed immediately. And they prepare a headline that says Vandenberg being appointed to the Senate. They think they've got a scoop. That's why he's been summoned to Lansing. And so Vandenberg is furious at being denied it. But in the meantime, the motorcycle policeman who's been sent to Saginaw, Michigan, to notify this retiring congressman that he's going to be appointed, is tracked down, pulled back before he can do that. And Vandenberg receives a letter at his office that is that's in green ink, which is what Governor Green used, and he assumes it's confirmation that he's not going to be appointed because he's been told by his chief aide that that's the case. Throws it away when one of the newspapers calls it. No, you are going to be appointed. He the story is that he goes down to the press room at the Grand Rapids Herald, and he and his employees are fishing through the trash trying to find this envelope, and sure enough, it says he's been appointed. And what turned out was the editor of the Detroit News later says that he then tracked down Governor Green, who was sort of in hiding at a hunting cabin in northern Michigan, and said, you can double cross Arthur Vandenberg, but you can't double cross the Detroit News, because they had the headline out there that, you know, would now be proved wrong and they'd be embarrassed. And so Green apparently reluctantly appoints Vandenberg and issues this statement of marvelous equivocation on Vandenberg's appointment that said he's a good Republican and the newspapers all agree, or something like that. And Vandenberg and Green don't even speak for like 6 months. There's an American Legion convention or something that they're both at in Detroit, and people notice that neither one is applauding or making eye contact with the other. And then after Vandenberg goes to Washington and Green is there for a meeting, Vandenberg's wife reports in the diary several months later that they had a good chat and they're now back on speaking terms. But it was a very fraught, dicey appointment, and it was really the power of the press that projected Vandenberg into the Senate for the first time.
There's this long-standing idea that when you go to the Senate, you enter Congress generally, that you should be seen and not heard. You should learn the ropes. Was this advice that Vandenberg took when he first entered the Senate?
Well, it was the standard advice at that time, and of course, as you know, social media and other things have changed that so much that I don't think that gets that sense of waiting your turn no longer is as strong as it was. It was very strong then, but in Vandenberg's case, he was appointed in the spring and he had to run for re-election in the fall. So he felt like he would, and he was He was the local newspaper editor. He was influential in party politics, but he wasn't a household name in the state. So he felt the need to establish himself very, very quickly. And so he wasted no time. And as an ambitious student of government, he had all kinds of ideas. And so he very quickly set about trying to do things, saving an Army Air Force base, Army Air Base near Detroit, and other sort of constituent services. And he also had just a wonderful challenge, because Michigan at that time was in the early stages of the auto boom, and its population had soared. It was one of the fastest growing states in the country. And the last census that had applied was in 1920, and in all the prosperity of the 20s, that's when Michigan had really boomed. And so Michigan and a number of other states, particularly California, had earned more congressional seats, and Vandenberg was wanting to and facing resistance, particularly from Southerners who would lose seats in that census, to champion a reapportionment that would gain the state congressional seat. So he did a lot of things to try to win recognition very quickly. Came across as a rather brash young character who was chided by by his colleagues, but he also was setting out, and this became a lifelong mark of his personality, but also part of his political achievement. He saw the need for compromise, and he came in just as Herbert Hoover was being elected in the fall of 1928. And Hoover, who was an engineering genius and in many ways an administrative genius, had no political background. He'd never run for public office before. And he comes into a Senate dominated by Republicans, but the Republicans are split down the middle between the old guard, as they styled themselves, who tended to be the more conservative Eastern Republicans, and the mavericks who were often Western progressives, such as William Borah in Idaho. And those two camps often didn't get along, and Vandenberg is trying to ingratiate himself with the new president and also have a foot in both of those camps to bring them together to support the president's agenda.
He's also elected to the United States Senate on the eve of the Great Depression. And you have this massive economic downturn that really upends American politics, changes the lives of millions of people. I was wondering if you could explain how he responded to this event and what this response reveals about him as a senator and as a politician.
He was, as a freshman senator from Michigan, so Hoover is elected in the fall of 28, the stock market crashes in the fall of 29, and the country is plunging into its worst economic depression ever. And Hoover really doesn't have the Hoover is hoping it will be a short-term thing, and of course, so is Vandenberg, so do Vandenberg and all the Republicans. But in Michigan, there were bank holding companies, as there were in many places in the country, that had been interlocking institutions. And there were two bank holding companies in Detroit that were on the verge of insolvency late in 1931 and excuse me, late in 1932 and early in 1933. So Hoover, of course, loses the election to Franklin Roosevelt, who brings a sense of optimism and activism that Hoover could not project. And and in Hoover's waning days, the federal bank examiners are coming in and saying, we've got to, well, the bank, Detroit bank executives are coming in and saying, we're on the verge of collapse. And that banking crisis in Michigan could trigger a nationwide banking crisis. And so Vandenberg is in the middle of trying to get a new Reconstruction Finance Corporation that had been created in the Hoover administration to come to the aid of the Detroit banks. It involves convincing Henry Ford, who's the largest stockholder in one of them, to put in more capital. And he's feuding with his former colleague, James Cousins, who's Michigan's senior senator, who is also very wealthy, and Hoover wants him to put in more capital. And Vandenberg's in the middle of this. But Vandenberg recognizes in the middle of this crisis that what he believes needs to be done to stabilize the banking system is a system of deposit insurance. Now, that's a program that had been advocated from time to time over the years by many people, including Vandenberg editorially. But Hoover and his Secretary of the Treasury, Andrew Mellon, had resisted it. And Roosevelt didn't want to involve himself in this banking crisis. He was going to let that be on Hoover's plate. And then when he came in, he declared a bank holiday. But Vandenberg kept pushing this deposit insurance idea. Roosevelt, like Hoover, resisted it. I think he and many people felt that if you had strong banks, in a sense, paying into a fund to bail out failing banks by insuring their deposits, that it would be pulling down the strong banks with the weak ones, and the weak ones, and that was bad policy. Vandenberg felt, and a growing body of opinion in Congress came to support him, that to restore confidence in the banking system as a whole, people needed to have comfort that their deposits would be insured. And so Roosevelt fought it, threatened to veto it. Even his vice president, John Nance Garner, however, was in favor of it, as were, and so Vandenberg put together a coalition, and was able to attach an amendment for federal deposit insurance to the Glass-Steagall Banking Act. And Roosevelt very reluctantly signed it, had threatened to knock it out, but reluctantly signed it. And then when it came time to renew it, claimed it as one of the foremost achievements of the early New Deal. And Vandenberg resented Roosevelt taking credit for it, but was grateful that Roosevelt, once it came in, vigorously endorsed it. And so that was his response to the Great Depression.
I find it's a great encapsulation of Vandenberg as a senator, even though he's Republican at a time when Democrats come to dominate the Senate. He is nonetheless able to influence events and get measures through. And we see that not just with his role in passing deposit insurance, but we also see it with a lot of the foreign policy debates that take place in the Senate in the middle 1930s. I was wondering if you could elaborate upon his role there, because it's really there that you start to see him assuming a much more prominent role in the Senate when it comes to the question of foreign policy.
That's right. He had been suspicious. I mean, we talked about the widespread disillusionment with Versailles and with the treaty and the post-war policies of the Europeans, and the question of how did America get pulled into this war? And Vandenberg started to introduce a bill each year that never got any traction to investigate the causes of World War I and of American involvement in the war. And in the mid-1930s, actually coming from what we would today think coming from the left, but coming from a there was a woman named Dorothy Detzer from the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom, and the peace movement, so to speak, was also wondering, how do we get into this war? If we understand that, maybe we can avoid future ones. And Vandenberg and a senator from North Dakota, Gerald Nye, came together through Dorothy Detzer and through others in Congress to pool both the Vandenberg was coming more from an American Legion standpoint and say, you know, was it the arms manufacturers and the financiers who got us into this war? And Nye is coming more from almost a semi-pacifist angle of how do we avoid future wars. But together the committee is called the Nye Committee, but Vandenberg is a big driver of that. Together they're trying to understand the origins of the war, and they're calling the DuPonts to testify, and they're Wall Street bankers, and they're looking into the causes of the war, and that they come away from that experience convinced, and here's Vandenberg drawing on Hamilton again, convinced that the role for the United States in a world that is becoming increasingly dangerous, because now in the 1930s you have Hitler and Mussolini and the Japanese war cabinet all coming to power and beginning to assert themselves in different conflicts, whether it's Hitler marching into the Rhineland or Mussolini attacking Ethiopia or the Japanese invading Manchuria. The world is becoming a more dangerous place. And Vandenberg's response to that and in his role leading the Nye Committee is to call for very strict American neutrality. And that neutrality debate further identifies him in the public mind and pushes him into a role as a leading isolationist. Now, his Senate mentor, William Borah, had been an isolationist for decades in the Senate, and he and Vandenberg and Nye are all in sync fighting Franklin Roosevelt's early attempts to quarantine the aggressors, to begin to have some foreign policy tools that can potentially aid threatened democracies, France and Great Britain, and potentially sanction the aggressors in some parts of the world or potential aggressors in Europe by being less neutral. And so that neutrality debate really pulls Vandenberg and elevates him in the public mind and in his own mind as a leading isolationist.
You describe how he's becoming this increasingly visible figure in the U.S. Senate when it comes to foreign policy and also on some other matters. And this, as he's doing this, the 1940 presidential election approaches. And you have this very interesting discussion in the book about his role in that election, because by 1940, he's been in the Senate for over a decade. He is a very prominent Republican. And that means that means something a bit more at this time, because so many Republicans have been wiped out in the 1930s. There are very few prominent Republicans left. Was he ever seriously considering becoming president? Was there ever a serious effort to give him the Republican nomination? What exactly happened with that in 1940?
Well, if we jump back a little bit to 1936, in the 1934 midterm election, Vandenberg was the only Republican senator from a major state to be reelected. In fact, and one of the very few governors to win re-election was Alf Landon in Kansas. And so Landon wins the nomination. So 1936 comes along, and Vandenberg is starting to be mentioned now as a dark horse, simply because there are so few Republicans, something like 17 left in the Senate after 1934. And so you sort of automatically elevated because there aren't too many others still standing. And you've been reelected when most everybody else has been washed away in a Democratic tide. And so Vandenberg is starting to get mentioned then in 36 as a dark horse. Landon really wants him as his vice president. And Vandenberg is resisting that with every bone in his body. He would love the idea of being president, but he doesn't see any attraction in this. And in Somebody congratulated him on avoiding being, you know, riding in the back seat of a hearse, because of course Landon was crushed. And so Vandenberg, and in fact, Landon's running mate was Vandenberg's good friend, Frank Knox, who was then the editor of the Chicago Sun-Times, I believe, but had started out his newspaper career also at the Grand Rapids Herald, and had been city editor when Vandenberg was a reporter, and had been one of those rough riders with Teddy Roosevelt in that campaign parade in 1900. So they went way back. But anyway, so Landon and Knox were famously carried, what was it, Maine and Vermont. So then 1940 is coming up, and Vandenberg is now one of the leaders in the Senate. There are so few Republicans, one of the Republican leaders, and has gained increasing visibility through these neutrality debates. And so really is viewed as a pretty serious contender, still thought of as a dark horse because the guy does not want to aggressively organize and campaign for it. He's very coy. He loves his ego loves the idea that maybe I'll be drafted, which really doesn't happen. But he's mentioned as a contender. And in 1939 is leading some polls as a prospective candidate, and particularly among editors and elite opinion, shall we say, is seen as one of the Republican front runners. But then in 1939, war breaks out in Europe, and suddenly that isolationist position looks a lot shakier than it did before, because Americans are facing some pretty tough choices when Western Europe is beginning to be overrun. I mean, there's this phony war until 1940, when Hitler is pushing into Poland, but hasn't made any big moves in Western Europe. But in any case, the isolationist position is looking a little shaky, and somebody who's an absolute isolationist maybe is a little too pure to cope with what might be coming. And at that time, the Republican candidates are potential candidates, Vandenberg, a young senator named Robert Taft, with a famous name and clearly bright and capable, but also very conservative and isolationist, and an untested young one prosecutorial wonder from New York named Thomas Dewey, who's made a name for himself busting gangsters but has no international relations or foreign policy credibility. And along comes this suddenly newly minted Republican and darling of the media named Wendell Willkie. And Willkie's much more flexible on foreign policy and says, you know, we've got some allies here, fellow democracies who may be under threat. And he adopts a line much more akin to Franklin Roosevelt's. And these sort of establishment conservatives don't gain traction. Vandenberg allows his name to be entered into the Wisconsin primary, but is out organized by Dewey, and this is early in the primary system, so primaries don't count for that many delegates, but are an early indication of public opinion. And Vandenberg finishes a distant second in the Wisconsin primary, right across the lake from Michigan, and really doesn't see any future for himself in the 1940 campaign, and doesn't pursue it after that.
So. But he nonetheless, after the election, he's still a very prominent voice in terms of foreign policy. And then a little more than a year later, you have Pearl Harbor and America's entry into the war. How does the war affect Vandenberg's perceptions? And when does he begin to reconsider his isolationism? And most importantly, what impact does that have on American foreign policy?
Just prior to Pearl Harbor, but after the expansion of the war in Europe in 1940 and early 1941, you have Roosevelt seeking tools to come to the aid of the Allies, and of course, most particularly Great Britain. And Vandenberg is resisting expansion of selective service. He's resisting the lend-lease aid, selling those destroyers or trading those destroyers to Great Britain. And then Pearl Harbor happens, and there is that natural, we've been attacked, we need to fight, we're all on the same side now, spirit through the country, and Vandenberg is certainly a part of that. But it also, Pearl Harbor also suggests that the oceans as moats that the isolationists have carried around in their imagination for a generation no longer can safeguard us, that modern warfare is changing. And so post-Pearl Harbor, Pearl Harbor is not only a wake-up call. He said it ended isolationism for all of us. That's a bit of an exaggeration, but it certainly was a piece of that. And then there are other pieces that are sort of interesting. Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, contrary to what some people might assume, is not named for Arthur Vandenberg. It's named for his nephew, Army Air Force General Hoyt Vandenberg, who was an early Secretary of the Air Force, an early Director of the CIA, but with Pearl Harbor had been in London during the German Blitz, was a student of modern warfare, of modern air wars. He's talking with Uncle Arthur, stopping by his apartment in Washington on a Sunday afternoon and excusing himself and going into the kitchen while the rest of the family's in the living room and talking about strategy. And he's one of the early people recognizing that isolationism from a military standpoint is no longer tenable. We mentioned it as a sort of scandalous aside, because it's fun to talk about, even though I think the influence was minimal. But Vandenberg was also having an affair with the wife of a member of the British embassy staff in Washington, who some people, and I say this in terms of knowledgeable reporters, say she was not only his neighbor they lived one floor up from the Vandenbergs in their apartment hotel in Washington, but was also planted by British intelligence to keep an eye on what the isolationists, with Vandenberg as their leader. Bora had died, by the way, in 1940, and Vandenberg then became the undisputed leader of the isolationist opinion in the Senate. But I don't think I think she may have been a wonderful informant, but I don't think she was a big influence. But then the bigger thing that happens for Vandenberg is in 1943, so the Wilkie runs, he's defeated by Roosevelt, but well, he hasn't got deep roots in the party, and the party establishment resents him as a sort of interloper. He does reflect a significant body of opinion that said this old isolationism has been shown to be an insufficient response to the realities of the modern world and of the modern war. And so the Republicans in 1943, the tide is beginning to turn in the war. The Allies are beginning to push back against the Germans and the Japanese, and the Republicans are looking ahead to 1944, where Wilkie is the titular head of the party, and again might have every expectation of challenging Roosevelt in 1944. And the Republican National Committee chairman says, you know, we're going to be split right down the middle if you know, we're isolationists and we're internationalist Wilkieites and we can't come together on a foreign policy platform. So he calls a meeting on Mackinac Island in northern Michigan and charges Vandenberg, who's on the Foreign Relations Committee and the chief Republican spokesperson at that point on foreign policy, to chair a group to come up with a platform for the Republicans can run on in 1944 that won't tear the party apart. And Vandenberg goes in there as a sort of widely viewed in the public as an isolationist. But this is at a time when people are beginning to think about what the world is going to look like after World War II. Because now it looks like the Allies, it may take, nobody knows how many years, but the Allies are going to win this. We can't make the same mistakes we made after World War I. There has to be some way to achieve a lasting peace. And Roosevelt has already coined the term United Nations, referring to the Allies. And there is a widespread sense that the United States can't walk away from an international consensus after the war, as we did after World War I. But what is that going to look like? Roosevelt does not want to make any commitments because he's got two allies, the Russians, who he's counting on, and he can't alienate with some plan for some group of democratic nations that will threaten them, and the British, who have this enormous colonial empire, much of it now occupied by Japan, much of it clamoring for independence, and the British want to hold on to some of that empire after the war. So Churchill certainly does. So Roosevelt is just saying, you know, I'm Dr. Win the War. Let's not be talking about what the world's like after the war, even as public sentiment is beginning to wander. And as people are beginning to introduce bills in the legislature, you know, proposals for post-war policy. Vandenberg at Mackinac Island gets the isolationists and the Wilkieites to agree on an expression that after the war, the United States will participate in an international organization as long as it doesn't infringe on our sovereignty, because you've got Wilkie writing about one world and people talking about world federalism and global police forces and things. But the Republicans approve something called the Mackinac Charter that calls for American participation in a post-war organization. And lo and behold, it's a namby-pamby document, but nobody else has done that yet. And Vandenberg has put it together. So all of a sudden, he comes away from that conference no longer being viewed as this hardcore isolationist, instead being viewed as someone who has crafted a first public response, and it happens to be Republican, to the need for a post-war organization that becomes the United Nations, with the United States participating. And the press, of course, loves that. And Vandenberg now is getting a lot of encouragement from that standpoint. So even though in the public mind he's still an isolationist, he's moved considerably away from his days on the Nye Committee saying, you know, we're not going to have anything to do with what happens in Europe.
He really is in a position of enormous influence, isn't he? Because he, in some ways, has inherited this potential mantle of Henry Cabot Lodge. He could have been an obstructionist. He could have been leading the charge against all the, you know, treaties and so forth that would have been would eventually be introduced in the Senate after the war. And yet he has that cachet of being the person who is reluctant. And yet, because of his conversion, if you will, or reconsideration, that he now has this enormous authority to say that, you know, I, with my doubts, am ready to embrace this role under certain circumstances. And in that sense, he becomes this indispensable person to the political element of defining America's post-war role.
That's so true. And I think cachet is a good word. So Roosevelt, too, Franklin Roosevelt, he and Vandenberg may be bitter adversaries in some respects, but he, too, recognizes that one of the things that went wrong with the League of Nations debate was that Wilson led that delegation to Versailles, the American delegation to the League of Nations conference, Wilson did not appoint a single prominent Republican. He didn't invite Henry Cabot Lodge. He didn't invite other party elders. And so when he comes back from Paris with this League of Nations covenant, he presents it to the Republicans, said, we're not going to make any changes. And, you know, they've had no say in it. And so it bred great resentment. And so Roosevelt, well, first of all, to back up a little bit, so as the war is now nearing its end, we'll jump to 1945. Roosevelt is being inaugurated for his fourth term. He's in frailer health than anybody realizes, but he also is about to embark for Yalta, and where the earlier summits between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin had been, there had been some talk about what would happen after the war, but the dominant questions were of you know, when will the United States open a second front with a Normandy invasion? What are our strategies during the war? Now in 1945, in early 1945, the war is on its way to being over, and the summit at Yalta is going to be preoccupied with what's going to happen after the war. And so on January 10th, 1945, where people like Vandenberg have spent their much of their political life suspicious of what Roosevelt plans. And Roosevelt, of course, really functioned as his own Secretary of State. If he had a delicate mission to Churchill or Stalin, he didn't send his Secretary of State. He sent Harry Hopkins out of the White House. Cordell Hull was often in the dark about what Roosevelt was doing, as were members of Congress. State Department couldn't keep them informed because State Department didn't always know what was going on. And so Roosevelt had played things so close to the vest that where Churchill and Stalin seemed to have a pretty clear agenda, partisans like Vandenberg didn't know what Roosevelt's was. And so Vandenberg stands up in the Senate on January 10th, 1945, and gives a speech proposing a post-war alliance of the victorious Allies to ensure that Germany and Japan will never again be military threats, and essentially a security agreement that says we're going to make sure that Germany no longer, as it has now twice in the last 30 years, can threaten the peace of the world. This is the isolationist calling for an entangling alliance, and that is sort of Vandenberg's breakout moment as saying isolationism is no longer in America's best interest. Roosevelt is, when he departs for Yalta a few days later, requests 50 copies of that speech. Now, whether that was for window dressing or not, I don't know. But Roosevelt, coming back from Yalta, recognizes that this United Nations that they're starting to create, and that they've set a scheduled to start later in the spring, a conference in San Francisco, that he cannot avoid appointing Vandenberg to the United States delegation. And that's it's a six-member delegation, and he has to have Vandenberg. And in fact, Vandenberg's appointment is to do exactly what you said, you know, to avoid that situation of Vandenberg becoming a Henry Cabot Lodge and having a United Nations charter presented to the Senate with automatic Republican suspicion and hostility. So he appoints Vandenberg. And in fact, Vandenberg meets with him and says, listen, I'm not going unless I can be an independent actor. I'm not going to toe your line necessarily, because we don't know what your line is. And in fact, Roosevelt pops some things on the delegation, like, oh, yeah, we gave Stalin three delegates. You know, we gave him an extra one for Ukraine and White Russia. And he says, we can have three also, but if you want. And so the delegates are suspicious right from the start. And Vandenberg has a meeting with Roosevelt just before Roosevelt departs for Warm Springs and says, hey, I can break a leg if you want to, because I'm going as an independent actor. And if you are worried about me dissenting, or if I draw too much flack for what I say about Soviet intentions or something, you know, I'll back out right now. And Vandenberg claims, and there's one observer who said, who corroborates this, that Roosevelt says to him, you know, actually, I Roosevelt too, coming back from Yalta, is increasingly wary of what Stalin's intentions are. And this is centered around Poland, and is he ever going to allow free elections, and what's going to happen? And Roosevelt says to Vandenberg, you know, if there's one person that I need on this committee, it's you. And that's both for the reasons of Senate passage and for the reasons of sort of proper wariness about Soviet intentions. Then Roosevelt dies. Harry Truman has had lunch with Roosevelt once in the brief time that he's been vice president. Really no, he's a student of the Senate, but he's not, no experience in foreign policy at all. The new Secretary of State, a fellow named Edward Stettinius, is a competent manager of the State Department, but has not had, he's been to Yalta, but he doesn't have any sort of high level stature in foreign policy. So Vandenberg, in essence, arrives at that conference to organize the United Nations in San Francisco as the most influential American delegate. And he's leaning over Stettinius's shoulder, telling him how to reply to what the Soviet foreign minister Molotov says when he says niet to something. And so that really is the beginning of Vandenberg's significant role in shaping post-war policy.
What were some of the other ways in which he shaped foreign policy over the rest of the decade? Because it was interesting to see how he didn't just play this role of being this informal representative, but as you describe, he's playing a role in a lot of other areas as well. He's in terms of public opinion, in terms of his role in the United States Senate, especially after the Republicans retake control of the Senate in 1946. He seems to be almost everywhere when it comes to American foreign policy in the late 1940s.
Well, his Democratic counterpart, Tom Connally, a senator from Texas, who they traded the foreign relations chairmanship, depending on which party was in power. They had been delegates to the United Nations. When they come back from the UN, of course, Harry Truman's a friend of theirs. And after all of Roosevelt's time in office, when Roosevelt really treated the Senate as a nuisance, and had big majorities, so he didn't need to cultivate any sort of much bipartisan support. And that Truman, in a sense, coming back and recognizing that he needs the Senate in ways that Roosevelt didn't, and he understands it. And he asks Connally and Vandenberg to join new Secretary of State James Burns, who, of course, many people thought should have been vice president and then president rather than Truman, and Truman may have been among them, in Paris for the post-war peace conferences with all of the countries who were allies with Germany, with post-war conference with Italy and Romania and Hungary. And so Vandenberg, with Connally, spends almost all of 1946, when he's actually up for re-election, in Paris at peace conferences. I should say in the fall of 45, he's also attending the first UN General Assembly in London. So he spent something like 200 days abroad. He came back to, and it was sort of unprecedented diplomatic activity for someone in the United States Senate. And in fact, he goes to that first UN General Assembly, and this is before there was an American ambassador to the UN. At that time, we had a delegation, and he was on the delegation with Connally and with Stettinius and with Eleanor Roosevelt. They were the American delegation, and it was funny because he and Eleanor Roosevelt had a very difficult relationship. He, of course, viewed her as the liberal on Franklin's shoulder, you know, pushing him even further away from Vandenberg's conservatism. And she had resented his attacks on her husband. He resented what he viewed as her socialist schemes. One of them was to create a planned community in Appalachia whose cottage industry would be furniture. And of course, Vandenberg was the senator from the furniture city of Grand Rapids, and he couldn't see federal dollars going into competition. And so he and Eleanor had this difficult relationship, but they sailed to London together for the first UN General Assembly. And after that, he wrote to one of his friends. He said, I take back everything I ever said about her, and it's been plenty. And she, in turn, begged him to stay on involved with the UN. But he said, I got to get back to the Senate. I've kind of got a day job here, and I can't do both. And so they ended up with mutual respect where they had been adversaries for so long. But he's involved in this up close foreign policy negotiations for all of 1946. He's getting to know Molotov and Vyshinsky, the Russians, and this is the Cold War breaking out. I mean, they're staring down each other over peace settlements, over whether there's going to be free commerce on the Danube, and what's going to happen in Yugoslavia, and is Trieste going to be a part of Italy? These big contentious issues, Vandenberg's in the middle of the negotiations, and then in 1947. You have the Republicans have taken control of the Senate. He is chairing the Foreign Relations Committee, and General Marshall makes a speech at Harvard calling for significant American aid to help in the reconstruction of Europe. And Vandenberg blanches at first. He's got enormous respect for General Marshall, but blanches at first at the kind of dollars being involved, but recognizes that chairing foreign relations, this is his baby to work on. He commissions a big study from the Brookings Institution to see if we put billions of dollars of aid into Europe, what will its effect on the American economy be? He negotiates with Marshall and the State Department to make it to pare back some of the requests, to make it big enough to be what they expect to be effective, but digestible enough to be sold to the Congress and the American people, who really are, they're just done with the war. They've just had rationing. They may have been spared destruction, but they really don't want to. They're just trying to get their economy back on a sound footing. And now we're going to do this massive foreign aid program, which, of course, coincidentally, is going to end up benefiting the American economy because we need those trading partners, but it's still a tough sell to the American people. And so Marshall and Vandenberg worked this out. And in fact, Marshall has a wonderful quote where he said, Truman was smart enough to call it the Marshall Plan, because if it were called the Truman Plan, it would be partisan and a problem, where Marshall had the new Secretary of State had such universal respect that his name would be a better sell. And then Marshall turned around and said, it could have been called the Vandenberg Plan, because when we got to the Senate, Van was just the whole show. And so Vandenberg was strongly identified with that. And then even as the European economies are beginning to recover, the Cold War is intensifying, and you've got the lone, and Americans want to bring their troops home. The Western European militaries are destroyed or decimated, and the Red Army is the most powerful military force on the European continent. And in Poland, they are not allowing free elections and doing some of the things that Stalin promised. And you've got an Iron Curtain descending, as both Vandenberg and Churchill have related in Vandenberg gave the earlier speech, but Churchill's got all the attention. And so the Europeans are saying, we think we see our economies beginning to come back, but we don't have any security here. And so they approach the United States and say, we need your help. And that's when Vandenberg writes the Vandenberg Resolution, which enables the United States to enter into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization with the Western European countries. And that, of course, is the next significant. Vandenberg had proposed an entangling alliance. Now this was an actual entangling alliance. And so you've got the UN and then the Marshall Plan and then NATO, really the three most important elements of American post-war policy, and Vandenberg is central to all three of those.
Well, we've taken a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh gosh, I'm still looking for direction on that, Mark. The question is, do you do something that is as if I had David McCullough's talents and aspirations, you would say, I'd like to learn something about something new. So I'll move to a whole different topic and do Lewis Cass because he played a role in from the organization of the Northwest Territory to the Trail of Tears to trying to avoid a confrontation at Fort Sumter that has gone unrecognized in American history. Or do you look at someone like William Fulbright, who was a Democrat, but an admirer of Vandenberg, who had to wrestle with some of the consequences of America's new global leadership that resulted in the Vietnam War. I don't know. I'm open to your suggestion. It's fun to think about, though.
Well, I am sure that whatever you eventually decide on, it's going to be a great book. Hank, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Mark, it's a real pleasure. Thank you.